Well, good morning, everybody who got up an hour earlier than usual today. I don't know if there are going to be more people coming in about an hour, but we'll find out. Well, welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen. I'm a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic background, every religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. And we also welcome you no matter what your age is or whatever your abilities or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. Sometimes they're presented by our minister, Sandy Ingham, sometimes by a member of the wider community, or sometimes, like today, by members of our own society, and that includes me and Kathy Converse, who are presenting today. Our opening words will be read by Al Nettleton.
These words are by E.E. Cummings. Cummings' father was a Harvard professor and a Unitarian minister, if you didn't know that. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and blue-dreamed sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birth day of life and of love and of wings and of the gay great happening illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears awake. And now the eyes of my eyes are opened.
The chalice lighting will be read by Ken Skog.
This reading is by Nancy Wood. Earth, cure me. Earth, receive my woe. Rock, strengthen me. Rock, receive my weakness. Rain, wash away my sadness. Rain, receive my doubt. Sun, make sweet my song. Sun, receive the anger from my heart.
Well, today our presentation is called Gardening, Body, Mind, and Soul, and I don't think I really have to introduce Kathy Converse, because if you've been coming to this church, you've known her for many years. And she's going to give the first part of the service, and I'll be giving the last part of it. So, Kathy.
I'm going to start with talking about gardening from the more biological aspect, and then Mary will talk about the more the aspects of how we go about doing this. So spring is definitely here, and anyone who's already a gardener, this means that we're out there moving leaves, taking down dead stalks, harvesting our compost from our winter bins, and reconnecting up our rain barrels. All the while we're enjoying fresh air and the constant chatter of birds, which seems so loud when it's been gone. Is our mouth watering thinking of all the good things to eat after a winter of less exciting produce? Sure, but what is the driving force that sends us out there, that makes us do that hard work year after year, even when we have disappointments due to failures to rain, disease, and other frustrations? I mean, you can just go to the grocery store or the farmer's market. Is it the snap, crunch, slurp that we associate with fresh produce from the garden? Or is it that we enjoy watching hummingbirds come to our garden flowers? As Prairie member Carl Wacker posted on Facebook yesterday, if it snows tomorrow, it's my fault. I just had to plant something. It's a good thing it didn't snow, Carl. For me, it's just in my blood. Based on family photographs, I was out in the garden in Vermont where I grew up as soon as I could stand up. With the exception of a few years living in cities and college, I've had a garden every year, sometimes being potted plants on my apartment balconies. I just can't imagine a summer with no gardening. Looking at some of the tangible results of gardening, I'm not alone in this endeavor, as we have master gardeners among us, and also many of you who have for many years enjoyed all types of gardening. But is this desire to garden just a personal preference? Or is there some tangible results of our gardening that keep enticing us back year after year? George Gordon of the Daily Mail wrote, "Those with green fingers have long known that gardening is good for you physically and mentally, and now it's been proven scientifically. Researchers have found that smelling roses and pulling up weeds can lower blood pressure, increase brain activity, and produce a general upbeat feeling." In 1984, environmental psychologist Roger Ulrich, and he was Texas A&M, found that patients recovering from gallbladder surgery in rooms where they had a view out the window of trees, that they actually had significantly shorter hospital stays, fewer complaints, took less pain medication, and had fewer post-op complications than other patients who were in a room that was just looking out at a brick wall. He was the first researcher to use the standards of modern medical research to document both experimental controls and quantifying results. Paul Shepard had a 1982 book, Nature and Madness, and he explored the effect of ever-diminishing engagement with wild nature on the psychology of human development. Theodore Rozak, in his 1992 book, The Voice of the Earth, coined the term eco-psychology, which is the study of the relationship between human beings and the natural world. There's many other terms who are now used for this whole field of eco-psychology, and there's just dozens of them. The ones I particularly liked were green psychology, global therapy, earth-centered therapy, and my favorite, re-earthing. I think every spring I feel like I'm re-earthing after being in Wisconsin. I grouped together several general ideas of health and wellness. There's a gazillion publications out there, so I put it into some general topics. The first is stress relief and self-esteem. Researchers in the Netherlands conducted a trial with two groups of people who were asked to do a very stressful task. They then were given a half an hour to either go out and walk in a garden, or they were inside reading a book. The gardening group reported a greater improvement in mood, and tests revealed that they had lower levels of cortisol compared to those who tried to relax by just quiet reading. I found that many of the studies talk about cortisol levels, and what lowering cortisol is important, because if you have chronically elevated cortisol levels, it can be linked to immune function problems, obesity, memory changes, learning problems, and heart disease. Or these are all stress-related diseases. In the Journal of Health Psychology, a study on gardening by Vandenberg and Custers showed that gardening definitely produced significantly stronger decreases in the cortisol, and the positive mood was fully restored after gardening. These findings provided the first experimental evidence that gardening can promote relief from acute stress. The second area is heart health and disease risk. Gardening may be a way to achieve your 2.5 hours of moderate intensity exercise that we all do every week, of course. But gardening, it may be a more rewarding motivation than feeling like a hamster running on a treadmill inside a building, particularly in the summer. Gardening is not only helpful in managing your weight, but also in reducing high blood pressure, heart disease, and other threatening diseases. In fact, gardening actually scored a space on the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's recommendation for battling high blood pressure. A large Stockholm study showed that regular gardening cuts stroke and heart attack risk by up to 30% for those people above 60. Simply viewing plants, not even being in the garden, just looking at them, has been shown to reduce fear, anger, blood pressure, and muscle tension. Gardening has been linked to significant beneficial changes in total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, and systolic blood pressure. Reported in the Journal of Environmental Psychology, researchers took 112 young stressed out adults, we probably have a lot of those around, and split them into two groups. The first group sat in a room which had a view of trees, and then they strolled through a garden. The second group sat in a windowless room and then went walking in an urban environment. The group that relaxed in the garden showed decreases in blood pressure and positive changes in feelings. Researcher Terry Hartog noted that some of these changes, particularly in blood pressure, could be seen within minutes of them entering these spaces. In addition, if you expose your limbs without sunscreen for about 10 minutes during the midday gardening, it will give you enough vitamin D to reduce risk of heart disease, osteoporosis, and various cancers. Keep in mind that low vitamin D levels are usually caused by spending too much time indoors. According to the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, the creation or increased access to places such as gardens for physical activity produced overall a 48% increase in this physical activity and a 5% increase in aerobic capacity, reduced body fat, weight loss, improved flexibility, and an increase in perceived energy. Besides being a great way to exercise, gardening motivates people to actually exercise for a longer period of time. People get out in the garden, they spend more time there than they would if they were just walking or biking. Gardening burns calories. According to the Centers for Disease Control, gardening for an hour can burn up to 330 calories. This is more than lifting weights for that same period of time. The National Institute of Health goes so far as to recommend 30 to 45 minutes of gardening 3 to 5 times a week as a part of a good exercise strategy. Their findings are particularly important for older adults, as this age group tends to have, during the course of a day, spend a lot of their active time performing regular tasks and find it difficult to actually have a regular increased exercise program. Hand strength and dexterity. As we age, we have diminishing dexterity and strength in our hands, and this can narrow the activities that are possible for us or pleasurable. Gardening keeps gardening keeps hand muscles vigorous and agile. Related research has inspired rehabilitation programs for patients that are disabled, particularly after strokes, and for them doing particular garden tasks of a satisfying and productive way of rebuilding their strength and ability. Brain health and Alzheimer's risk. A new systematic review looked at the impact of gardens and outdoor spaces on mental and physical well-being of people with dementia. The research suggested that garden use, even if it's as simple as watering plants, walking through a garden, or sitting in a garden, led to decreased levels of both agitation and anxiety among these patients. Interesting, while spending a time in a garden may help relieve some dementia symptoms, it may also reduce your risk of developing dementia in the first place. One long-term study followed near 3,000 older adults for 16 years, keeping track of what levels of dementia they had and look at all their different lifestyle choices. Researchers found that gardening represented the single biggest risk reduction for dementia, reducing incidence by 36%, and another study estimated the risk reduction at 47%. Immune regulation. This one's a wild card. Not only does the vitamin D you're soaking from the summer sun help you fight off colds and flus, but it turns out that even the dirt under your fingernails may be working in your favor. Christopher Lowry, assistant professor of integrative physiology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, has been injecting mice with an organism, Mycobacterium vaccae. This is a harmless bacteria commonly found in soil, and he's found that in mice, this exposure can increase the release and the metabolism of serotonin in parts of the brain that control cognitive function and mood. Serotonin production helps to make you feel happier and more relaxed. No wonder so many people describe their garden as their happy place. Digging in the dirt isn't the same as taking Prozac, as Lowry says, but he agrees that humans evolved with this organism, this M. vaccae, and a host of other friendly organisms that, in relative lack of contact with soil and contact with these quote-unquote old friends, in our current environment has maybe the reason why some of us have our immune system thrown out of whack. By reintroducing this bacteria in our environment, it may help us alleviate some medical problems, Lowry says. Larry Dossey, author of One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Great Consciousness and Why It Matters, what a title. He writes, we know that children who are exposed to dirt in the formative years develop healthier, stronger immune systems when compared to children whose parents kept them squeaky clean. So that makes me feel good. There's no squeaky clean in my house. And they have a lower incidence, these children have a lower incidence of asthma, eczema, and allergies later in life. Exposure to dirt in childhood promotes good health. Subject of depression and mental health. The growing field of horticultural therapy has given proven results for relief with people with depression and mental illness. In a study in Norway of people who had either depression, low mood, or bipolar 2 disorder, they had them spend 6 hours a week growing flowers and vegetables. After 3 months, half of the participants had noticeable improvement in their depressive symptoms. And what was more interesting is that this elevation of the mood actually continued for over 3 months after the study was ended. The evidence of getting a positive boost from gardening is being used to treat hospital patients. It's used in schools, to plan cities, and even to calm prisoners in jails. Horticultural therapists are being employed by major cities, such as Chicago, to help plan parks and botanical gardens. Several schools of architecture now have academics on the staff to study the different kinds of gardens that are most likely best to relate to people, for people to relate to. At New York's notorious Rikers Island Jail, horticultural therapy is used to calm prisoners and prepare them for their release. They have a greenhouse project, which has transformed a neglected site into a small oasis, with butterfly and bird gardens, a medieval-style herb garden, and a waterfall. In hospitals and rehabilitation centers throughout the U.S., they have healing gardens, which are there for patients, but they're also being used by nurses and doctors who are under stress and trauma from dealing with all of the illness and death that they have to face. Horticultural therapists say gardens produce the most positive effects on mental health, but they're also beneficial for stroke patients, those recovering from physical trauma, or people with disabilities. A simple thing is growing a potted plant. From a cutting gives them a feeling of control, says Teresa Hazen, who oversees the horticultural therapy programs at Oregon. Gardening, more than most rehab activities, has the ability to be very distracting. Simply by taking people's minds off their problems can relieve pain and also depression. On nutrition, final one. The food you grow yourself is the freshest and healthiest food you can eat. Not surprisingly, several studies have shown that gardeners eat more fruits and vegetables than their peers. Somebody's got to eat all that zucchini, kale, and tomatoes. People who garden or who live with someone who gardens, that could be good and bad, tend to eat more fruits and vegetables on a daily basis. A study in Flint, Michigan showed that only 17% of people from non-gardening families ate the necessary amount of fruit and vegetables, but that in families that garden, it went up to 32%, met the nutritional guidelines. Eating organic local produce reduces exposure to chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and also local food doesn't have to have the preservatives in it that are needed to, if it's transported long distances. Studies of after-school gardening programs suggest that kids who garden are more likely to eat fruits and vegetables. And they're a lot more adventurous about giving new foods a try, says Ann Palmer, who's a program director of Eating for the Future at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. I've watched a lot of cooking and gardening classes with kids. It's amazing how many will try things like arugula, a green that has a pretty strong flavor, and they'll say, wow, this is good. The American Heart Association has planted more than 200 teaching gardens across the country. And teaching gardens are a proven tool in the fight against childhood obesity. They're fun, hands-on ways for youngsters to learn what it means to be healthy, and more importantly, they take this information home to their families. As we've heard in the book this morning, children learn how to plant seeds, nurture growing plants, and harvest produce. Teachers can make garden-themed lessons to teach nutrition, math, and science. Students were interested in trying new foods because they had grown them and they felt a closer connection to them because of the garden. And my conclusions, not Mary's, but mine, extended exposure to nature and wildlife increases people's compassion for each other because their compassion for the environment increases in their life. Many gardeners view their hobby as the perfect antidote to the modern world, a way of reclaiming some of the intangible things that we've lost in our busy, dirt-free lives. We live in a society where we're just maxing out all the time in terms of paying the kind of directed attention that we need for cell phones and email and computers and such. Andrew Traylor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign says, when that capacity gets used up, we tend to become irritable, error-prone, distractible, and stressed out. Trading your BlackBerry for BlackBerry bushes may be an excellent way to fight stress and attention fatigue. The longer you garden, the more you realize how many different ways you benefit, beginning with your body, extending to your intellect and creative abilities, and finally reaching to your soul. The biologist Edward O. Wilson calls this garden connection biophilia, which is, we're distinctively drawn to connect with other living, growing things. We want to feel part of the web of life.
Well, this reminded me of when I invited a CSA farmer to my fourth grade class years ago, and he brought a big box of lettuce and onions and carrots and whatever he was producing at that time. And I had the impression that kids didn't like fruits and vegetables, but when he finished his talk, he offered that they could come up and have anything they wanted to eat out of that. And those kids came up there, they were like, it was like a feeding frenzy. They were eating those onions, they were eating lettuce, they were grabbing everything that was in that box. And it just goes to show that if you talk it up and you've got food, they'll eat it, even if you think they don't like fruits and vegetables. Well, 7 years ago, we had a service on gardening we called the Zen of Gardening and Gardens, and a group of Prairie members talked about two topics. They talked about how they became gardeners, and then they talked about the problems of gardening and also mostly the satisfactions of gardening, and it was really a fun service. Some of the satisfactions people mentioned resonate with the research that Kathy just talked about. For example, Pat Watkins mentioned how she loved lying in the ground on the ground in her yard, which was kind of a wild garden, and just weeding that garden. And she just got a tremendous a feeling of happiness there. I talked about how the garden for me was a garden of connections that connected me with my past when I was a young child and I was given a little plot to take care of. And also with nature, of course, and then with the people I shared my produce with, because if you have a garden, you always have too much. and then we also laughed when Kate Franzman showed us a piece of bindweed, which she said was the bane of her existence in her garden. If you ever see bindweed, you know, you've got to keep pulling it the entire year. Yeah, and a major highlight was Carl Wacker's PowerPoint show about his garden so that we could really enjoy what he grows. Well, the focus of my part of this service will be a little different from that time. I'll be focusing on community gardening as opposed to, say, backyard gardening or gardening in general. You might ask why I'm focusing on community gardening. And one reason is that I started a community garden in the Marlboro Park, just a quarter of a block from here, about 45 years ago, and I still garden there. I started that garden because in this neighborhood, the yards are very small, and my yard was a 40-foot yard, and it was shady, and so I couldn't really grow a garden. And that Marlboro Park at that time had just stopped being a farm, and it was development land. So I thought, I want to have a garden out there, but I thought, if it's just me, it's going to get vandalized to nothing. So I think I'll get some company. So first I talked to the developer, and he said, he was a gardener too, and he said if he could have a gardener, we didn't have to pay any rent for that land. And so I went around to all the neighbors and got about 25 gardeners, and that was our first garden. Well, now if you look on those two, on the side walls, you'll see that Marlboro Garden has grown to about 160 plots. And if anyone's interested in having a plot there, there's a registration this Wednesday, or you can just see me after the service. Anyway, so that's one reason, because I've had some good experiences in Marlboro Garden. And also it turns out that community gardens have additional benefits just beyond backyard gardening, which I'd like to tell you about. And also there are many community gardens in Dane County. You were supposed to have a handout, but was there a handout that got here? I guess not. Have to turn it over to you next week. Because there's a website on the Gardens Network site that shows you all the gardens in Dane, all the community gardens in Dane County. If you go to that website, you can go to the map, and it's an interactive map, and you can just put your cursor on the little dot, and it'll show you where the garden is, what the garden is, and who to contact to get in the garden. And then, just in case some of you might think of organizing a garden yourself, a community garden sometime, I have a list of criteria that someone put out. All right, so first I'd like to give you some insights from my firsthand experience in the Marlboro Community Garden that's right here in the neighborhood. Well, why I like it is that it's a much better location than my garden. First of all, it's sunny, whereas my yard is shady. Secondly, it's very spacious. It's several acres, and that park is 20 acres, so you feel like you're really out in the country. It's unhindered by tree roots, no trees right next to the garden. And also I often have experiences with birds. Oh, looks like this handout's here. Great. And also it's away from home. And you know, sometimes you just have to get out of your house. If you get out of your house, your mood changes, and especially if you go to the garden. But I want to point out that in a community garden, you also develop friendships that you don't if you're just working in your backyard garden. I've gotten to know my neighbors and my gardening neighbors, and some of them are people from the neighborhood, a lot better because we garden next to each other and we stop and talk to each other and visit. But beyond that, it's a multicultural experience in a place where I can form friendships across ethnic lines. In our garden here, it's about 65% Latino gardeners. And although I have neighbors who are from Puerto Rico, I didn't get to know them. I got to know my Latino neighbors who are in the garden much better because some of them work on a committee with me, or I see them at work days, and I find that that's a really big benefit, something that I don't get just by sitting in my house or working in my backyard garden. And I also have used this as a way to bridge the gulf between myself and my African-American neighbors on Allied Drive. You may know that I'm involved in my neighborhood association, and for a long time we had a very negative person on our neighborhood council who always talked about those people over there on Allied Drive, by which she meant the black people, and how criminal they were and things like that. And I could, after years of listening to her, I could find myself starting to have a negative attitude toward them. And I thought, I have to do something about this. Because I've been taught as a young child, you know, everybody is equal. And I didn't like this attitude that I was finding was rubbing off on me. And I'd also been an exchange student down at Spelman College, which is a black women's college in Atlanta, Georgia. So, you know, I shouldn't have been prejudiced. I shouldn't have had this fear, but I started to have this fear just because of the negative stuff that this person in our neighborhood was feeding to us time and time again. So at that time, I decided, well, what can I do to counteract this? And I said, well, maybe I could mentor a black person in my garden. Because in our garden, if we're lucky if we have one black person there. Because they come from an urban society, you know, their grandparents, great-grandparents grew up in Mississippi or Arkansas or somewhere where they were gardeners. But when those people came to Chicago, they stopped gardening. And then when they came to Madison, you know, by that generation, they had no experience whatsoever. So I did mentor a black woman, two different black women in my garden in 2010 and 2011. And I wouldn't say it was a success as far as gardening was concerned, but it certainly was a success in making a friendship with those two women and with getting a totally different attitude and feeling very comfortable than in my neighborhood. And then I also see a really gigantic benefit for the new immigrants to our part of the world. For Latinos and the Southeast Asians who are also members of our garden, I think it's especially important because for them, because they come from an agrarian society, and this is probably the only thing that feels like a comfortable thing to them, feels like at home when they're out in the garden and growing the things that they used to grow. And I'm glad that, you know, we have that opportunity for them as well as, you know, just for their own benefits. And as Kathy pointed out, you know, it probably does relieve a terrible stress that they're feeling. In 2010, the benefits of community gardens from research are many. Some of, I'm talking about community gardens, not just gardens in general. And we had a PhD student from the University of Wisconsin do some research on community gardening and gardening in general in the Madison area. Vincent Smith was his name. And he asked the people that he recruited to keep track of everything that they harvest. He gave us a little scale, and we measured things to the tenth of an ounce, I think it was, all through the season. And he came out and measured our gardens so he knew how many square feet we had. And here are a couple of his findings. He found that community gardens were just very, very slightly less productive that year in pounds per square foot. But he found that community gardens were more productive money-wise, because what he did is when we turned in our, each week, he found the prices of things that were for sale that we would be growing in our gardens. And then he did all these calculations to see how much we raised and how much it was worth. And he found that the community gardens were more productive money-wise per square foot. In the community gardens, we made $1.21 per square foot for the season. And the home gardens made $1.08 per square foot. And he also found that community gardens, people raised more calories per square foot as well. About 69 calories per square foot for the community garden and about 58 calories per square foot for other gardens. But what was most surprising to him was that he learned that they didn't just talk about how they got fresh food or how it was healthier food or things like that. They talked to him about how gardening was therapeutic, just like Kathy said. It was a place where people could forget their cares. They talked about how their minds cleared up when they were out in the garden. They talked about how spiritually satisfying, they used that word, spiritually satisfying. And they felt like they were really a part of things, of a continuous process. And this was really surprising to him because his focus was, you know, the money, the economics of it. So that was his research. I just want to add one thing about other research about community gardens. They found that opening a community garden, especially in a most disadvantaged neighborhood, really increases the property values around the garden. Within 1,000 feet of the garden, they go up. And then he found that study found that community gardens strengthen neighborhoods in other ways. They give rise to a whole series of social processes, including social connections, like I've talked about. Reciprocity, give things away to your gardener, to your friends, mutual trust, collective decision making. We try to do that in our garden. Civic engagement and community building. So this was especially noted in disadvantaged areas. Now I know we're just about to the end here, but I want to share one more topic. And that is criteria for choosing a community gardening site. And when I started the Marlboro Garden back about 1970, I didn't know anything about this research. Maybe there hadn't even been any done about, you know, what the characteristics of a community garden should be. But I had seen the Eagle Heights Garden, and I'd traveled to Germany. I'd seen they had acres and acres of community gardens outside their cities. And when I wanted, you know, that place where I could grow things better than I could in my yard, I thought, well, why not start a community garden? And it turns out that this space out in this Marlboro Community Garden does fit a lot of these criteria. Maybe that's why it's been pretty successful. First, it should be in an area where there's a concentrated population. We have apartments here, and we have very small lots, we have renters. So renters and condo owners and a concentrated residential area means you've got a critical access, a critical mass of people that don't have access to land, so they're wanting it. If you have more low-income people, they're more likely to want to supplement their income, and that's true of this neighborhood. If you have a high percentage of recent immigrants from agrarian backgrounds, well, that's true here. It wasn't necessarily true in the beginning, but after the Vietnam War, we had an influx of Hmong people here, and of course, they love to garden. And then more recently, we've had many, many Latinos move into the neighborhood, so that's that agrarian background. You should be sure you should place it where it's not served by another community garden. Well, that was true here. Hopefully, you have good soil quality, not contaminated by lead, and something that we didn't actually test our garden, but it had always been a farm, so we assumed it was good land. It should be flat, pretty flat up there, sunny, water available. Well, at first there wasn't. We had to ask the neighbors to use their hose to fill up garbage cans with water so we'd have water for planting. But later we got a community block grant from the city and put in some hydrants, so now we have water. Let's see, a couple more things. Should be at least 100 feet from a public street, but we're up there in the middle of the park, so it's more than 100 feet. Should be a concentrated area, not just a strip. Well, some of the Madison Gardens are along railroad right-of-ways. That's not the ideal because you just have a narrow area, but we have about 3 acres now up there. Should be visible from neighborhood residences. I think that's because it can prevent vandalism and because people feel safer if they know someone else is around. And I guess that's all I'll say about that. So I hope that my little part of the talk here has given you some insight and enthusiasm for community gardening. And if you're not already involved in a community garden, or gardening at all, that now or later, when that door opens, I hope you go through it. Kathy will read our closing words.
Now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It is today that our best work can be done, and not some future day or future year. It is today that we fit ourselves for the greater usefulness of tomorrow. Today is the seed time. Now are the hours of work, and tomorrow comes the harvest and the playtime.
Well, I want to add that you can pick up a package of seeds out in the lobby in the window there. I got these free seeds from Dane County UW Extension. They're either flower seeds, or if you'd like to grow mini pumpkins, mini gourds, those are in that pet. So help yourself to one of those. And I'll extinguish the chalice in a minute, and please greet your neighbor. Have a good day.